The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Jason Phipps. Alok is off to Antarctica, and more of that in the coming weeks. But this week's podcast is dedicated to an extensive and in-depth conversation Alok recently recorded with the leading theoretical physicist Nima Arkani-Hamed. Alok is joined by the science writer Graham Farmello. Both Graham and Nima recently took part in a day of discussions to mark the opening of the Collider exhibition at the Science Museum in London. The Collider exhibition translates the incredible science being done at the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, Switzerland, giving visitors a unique insight into the vast and complex tools used to uncover the fundamental building blocks of matter. With this in mind, Alok quizzed Nima about the recent discovery of the Higgs particle and the consequence of this discovery for the field of particle physics. Going beyond the Higgs, Nima discusses the next set of experiments for the scientists at CERN, the search for supersymmetry. Why his certainty about the existence of the Higgs is not completely matched when it comes to supersymmetry, and why this doubt is fuel in the furnace of both theory and experiment at the cutting edge of physics.
Graham, Nima, welcome to you both. Nima, let me begin with you. What's going to be hopefully a very interesting, crunchy theoretical physics podcast, right? I'd like to know your opinion on the discovery of the Higgs boson last year, because we're all obsessed with it here in the non-technical world. What does it mean to physicists like you?
Well, the discovery of the Higgs is probably the most important experimental discovery in particle physics for decades. The Higgs has a very important conceptual role to play in our understanding of nature. Something that we understood in the 20th century is that the essential properties of the particles and forces that describe everything we see in the world around us are almost entirely dictated by some very general and basic physical principles that were discovered early in the 20th century, the principles of relativity and of quantum mechanics. And we've discovered that almost everything we see follows essentially inevitably from those basic principles. And the story of the Higgs is the close, in a sense, of that arc of conceptual developments of 20th century physics. What the Higgs allows us to do for the first time is something that until we discovered the Higgs we didn't have in our hands, but which we finally do have in our hands, is we have a theoretical structure that describes everything we know about the particles and forces that we've experimentally seen, that works, it's accurate, it's correct at the energy scales and the small distance scales that we've probed, and yet for the first time allows us to self-consistently extrapolate our understanding of those laws to energies that are vastly higher than any other energy scale.
So what you're talking about here is the standard model of particle
physics. I'm talking about the standard model of particle physics. But until the Higgs was discovered, at every moment in our history before that, there was some phenomenon, something which told us that the current understanding we had with the particles and forces that we had seen had to break down within only a factor of 5 or 10 higher energies or shorter distances than we had probed experimentally. Finally, with the discovery of the Higgs, we have this structure that makes sense. It makes self-consistent theoretical sense and can be extrapolated to exponentially higher energies.
But this is more than just full stop, isn't it? Because the Higgs was the last piece of the standard model and completed that. But that makes it sound like you've done now. I mean, clearly that's not true.
It's almost the other way around. With the discovery of the Higgs, what we've completed is really confirmed, because many of us knew for a long, long time that the Higgs or something very much like it had to exist. But what we've really completed is, if you like, a mechanical understanding of how the particles interact with each other, what the elementary particles are and mechanically how they interact with each other. But we're left with, in a sense, we're able to now articulate for the first time and properly articulate as scientific questions an entirely different kind of question, a much more structural question, not about what this or that particle is that we may find as we go to higher energies, but why we got this particular kind of theory in our hands that describes nature. Because as it turns out, the particular sort of theory we have with the Higgs, with its detailed properties, is utterly mysterious from many deeper points of view. If you like, one of the slogans of what we learned from 20th century physics is that the principles of relativity and quantum mechanics seem to make the universe inevitable. But one of our central difficulties in the 21st century is that in many ways the same principles seem to make the universe impossible. And we'd like to understand how we manage to get the universe that we actually have.
Well, we'll come back to the question of whether the universe is possible or not. I mean, I'm sensing that it is possible, given that we're sitting here talking within it. But Graham...
I did say seems to be impossible.
Graham, your book on Paul Dirac came out, seems like a long time ago now, but it wasn't really that long ago, The Strangest Man. You talked about him, he was working with pencil and paper, didn't even have computers back then to do some of the kinds of calculations and the kinds of things that, you know, in nowadays that Niebuhr and his colleagues are doing on supercomputers and various other things. I mean, were the challenges that faced him in the early days of quantum mechanics as difficult or more difficult than what Niebuhr's up to now? And we're going to talk about some of the complex stuff he's up to, but what's the comparison?
Well, when he started off as a graduate student in Cambridge, the best quantum model they had of the atom was the Bohr atom, which is basically a nucleus with electrons moving around in stuff like planets going around the sun. And the more he studied that model, the more dissatisfied he was with it. But he found it, like everybody else, extremely difficult to see how to make it in any way rigorous. And at that time, there were people, I didn't think I put this in my book, actually, but subsequently nailed, that people were saying, this is a problem just too difficult. We're never going to solve this problem.
The right? problem of what? One atom?
Well, yes, of making a rigorous version of the Bohr atom. It just looked too damn difficult. There were, you know, several hundred physicists trying to work on this thing. They knew it was in miraculous agreement with several experimental results. But to do better, to generalize it to heavier atoms, to make it rigorous so that the electrons didn't all fall into the nucleus, seemed impossible. And then the great revelation for Dirac came when Heisenberg, from left field, as far as he was concerned, came up with this completely new way of looking at quantum mechanics, which really, it looked completely different to the way Bohr did it. It focused on observables. It represented observables using things called matrices, and it was a completely different way of looking at things. And Dirac cast that aside initially, thinking that nature just couldn't be that complicated. And then, wham, he brought into the party the mathematics and indeed the geometric skills he'd learned in technical drawing classes and what have you, to give a new perspective on it. And then they had this enormous breakthrough that yielded quantum mechanics and quantum field theory that Niebuhr's been talking about.
When you say observables, do you mean actually the observations of a particle's mass, momentum, those sorts of things, or is it something more complicated than that?
What Heisenberg sought to do, following Einstein's guide, was to concentrate solely on observable quantities rather than things in Bohr's model which were not directly observable. And that was a very helpful guide to Heisenberg, although actually Einstein later said he didn't quite mean that. But so constantly theoreticians make this progress, not fully understanding what they're doing or even half understanding guidance that they're given. But what was so remarkable, I think, was how quickly that revolution took place. Once that seam was opened by Heisenberg and roughly the same time Schrödinger, then the world opened up. But then they hit something that Dirac found an insuperable barrier, and that was very simply that when he used a simple quantum field theory, he looked at the interaction between a simple electron and a single photon, and a simple calculation would give infinity when you look at the energy of that system. And he said, this is just impossible. And, you know, to the end of his life, he did not believe that problem was solved.
That problem was solved eventually,
Not in Dirac's eyes.
Not in Dirac's
eyes. Niebuhr will enlighten us on this, but he never accepted that solution.
Well, let's go back to that question of mine, which is that actually, the interaction between electrons and photons, these infinities, which were, let's say, contained in with quantum field theory as it became in the 50s and 60s and 70s to develop the standard model. And those problems were contained. They still have problems, but they were there. in a sense, that was the big sort of project of the 20th century in terms of quantum mechanics, wasn't it? To develop quantum field theory, the many multiple Nobel Prizes and all experiments and detectors and all sorts of things. But when you, Graham, sort of saying that Dirac, one of possibly the greatest physicists ever lived, thought he couldn't solve the problem of two particles, and yet now Nima is going to be talking about whether space exists or not and the cosmological constants and all this. Which is the grand? Which is the more difficult problem?
Steve Weinberg has a very nice saying, one of the intellectual heroes of our field, and it's nice to have one of our intellectual heroes say this, which is that in all of science, and certainly in our science, we have heroes but not prophets, which means that even the greatest intellects of previous times aren't necessarily privy, or even don't even necessarily understand what the central and most difficult problems end up being, and don't necessarily appreciate when the solutions have been found. Mm-hmm. And it's reasonable. In order to make big discoveries in physics, it's very helpful to have a certain kind of strong intellectual personality, which can be incredibly helpful when you're going up against problems that are very difficult and other people haven't managed to solve, but which can then later be a barrier to absorbing the correct solutions to those problems discovered by others. Yeah. In this case, Dirac's picture that the understanding of the infinities in quantum field theory was never complete, we now feel as it was not only wrong but as deeply wrong, that people like Ken Wilson, who eventually came along and taught us really how to think about quantum field theory, taught us not only isn't it that we're hiding these infinities under the rug, but that these things that appear like infinities are actually very deeply physical and important guides to understanding what the physics is actually doing, and that he taught us how to think about physics organized on different scales. And if you look at what's going on at shorter and shorter distances, for example, the effective strength of the interactions and even the kinds of particles and forces we should be including in our description of the physics can change as we go to shorter distances or equivalently go to longer distance scales. That's turned into a machine for our theoretical understanding of the world, and is incredibly powerful and works. And we now think of the Standard Model of Particle Physics not as a final complete theory that makes mathematical sense all by itself, but as merely an effective theory. And Wilson invented this idea of an effective theory, something that works and describes physics at the scales that we can probe experimentally today, one that does at least self-consistently make theoretical sense as we go to much, much higher energies, but one which eventually has got to break down for a whole variety of reasons.
So the Standard Model has been very successful as a theory, and with the Higgs boson, you've basically now got a consistent one, as you say. But as you hinted, it can't be the complete picture. There are
it's
so
definitely
many
not the complete picture.
Questions out there.
Yes.
That it doesn't answer. I mean, to take us through some of those.
Well, so there are two kinds of questions, which have a rather different character, although many of us think about both of these kinds of questions together. The first essential difficulty is that at least one of the real pillars of our understanding of quantum field theory, one of the two pillars of 20th century physics that the quantum field theory is based on, is the idea of space-time. And, of course, Einstein taught us that there isn't just space and time, that there's this mix of the two of them. And furthermore, that fundamentally, when particles interact with each other, they hit each other at points in space and time. So a little more technically, this is called the idea of locality, that interactions don't happen instantaneously across distant reaches of space, but have to occur at points in space-time.
Right.
Of course, it's a very familiar – well, it's a familiar as an idea now, but it wasn't familiar as an idea in Newton's time, of course, who did have a picture of action at a distance for explaining gravity, for example. The idea of space-time is really hardwired into our description of nature. And yet we have lots and lots of reasons to believe that because of the effects of both quantum mechanics and gravity at the same time, that space-time can't exist fundamentally.
Let's pause there for a second. Space-time in Einstein's theory of special relativity, general relativity, is essentially not something that exists in the background like we imagine space to be, where everything else happens on top of it, stars, planets, us, we all move around on top of it. It's actually part of the arena of action.
Yeah,
and
it
twists and bends and is affected by forces as well. So it becomes a player And then you're saying now that it doesn't even exist.
Yeah, so I mean, this is not meant to be an unstartling comment. We think it's true. We think that space-time has got to be somehow an approximate idea, an approximation to something deeper. And there are very simple reasons we believe this. One of the nice things about this part of physics is that the really big questions are very simple to state and even very simple to explain where they come from. Of course, trying to explain in detail what the candidate answers to the mysteries are is more complicated. But the actual questions are very simple to state. And one of the reasons we believe that space-time is approximate is we can do a thought experiment and see what happens if we try to measure, you know, little small distances or small times. What we've learned since quantum mechanics and Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is that in order to probe shorter and shorter distances of space and time, we need to use higher and higher energies. That's one of the reasons, ironically, experiments like the LHC, which are probing the tiniest distances we've ever probed before, are so gigantic because they have to get the particle collisions up to these enormous energies in order to probe the tiny distances. Well, in a world without gravity, nothing stops you from probing shorter and shorter distances. You have to find larger and larger world governments to fund bigger and bigger accelerators, but nothing. We can come back to how long it'll continue to work, but conceptually, nothing stops you. However, in a world with gravity, something eventually changes, and that's because you end up putting so much energy into such a tiny region of space. And since energy and mass are equivalent, famously through E equals mc squared, you put so much mass, therefore, into such a tiny region of space that you collapse a region that you're trying to look at into a black hole, and you make it impossible for any information to get out of exactly the little region you're trying to look at. If you get frustrated by the fact that it happened and use an even more powerful accelerator, what happens is you make an even larger black hole. You make it even more difficult for yourself to probe what's going on.
Why is nature hiding information from us?
Well, at some very deep level, we don't know. but there is something really there's something likely very, very important about the lesson of this thought experiment, which is that since we can't even in principle measure short distances and times to perfect accuracy because of gravity, then you could, of course, go on believing that they're really there and you just can't measure them. But we've learned over the last 100, 150 years that thinking along those lines isn't fruitful, that when we can't even in principle give operational meaning to certain things in physics, those things probably don't actually exist and they're approximations to something deeper. We got used to this in quantum mechanics where we discovered that we could know the position and velocity of a particle at the same time. We could know one or the other to perfect accuracy, but we couldn't know both. Well, here it seems like we can't know what space-time is fundamentally. But that's meant to be startling. It is startling because physics has changed a lot over the past 400 years. But one thing which hasn't changed is that what it's been about is describing how things move around in space as they evolve through time. So getting rid of space-time is going to be a major conceptual leap.
Well, you're talking about here about space-time being emergent. Can you give us any sense of the possible ways in which you could investigate what it emerged from, and do you see it ever being possible to investigate those ideas experimentally?
String theorists over the last 15, 20, 25 years, although more directly for this question, really in the last 15 years, have been making progress on exactly this question. And it's possible to make progress on these questions, in a sense, purely theoretically. One reason, of course, ultimately, we're interested in what's happening in our universe, and ultimately, experiment decides what's right and wrong. But these rules of relativity and quantum mechanics fuse in this framework of quantum field theory are so incredibly restrictive that you can't go around monkeying with them at will, randomly, in a way designed to try to solve some of these problems. If you do that, you'll crash the entire 400-year set of successes that we've been having in fundamental physics. And so any attempt to make sense of these ideas, for example, you could say, I know what's going on. As we go to very short distances, we'll discover that that instead of having a continuum of space-time, it's like a crystal. It's like atoms of space-time, something like that. Just like when you look at the surface of a table, it looks smooth. But as you go down to very small scales, you see it's actually made out of atoms. Yeah. Could it be something like that? That's a very naive idea for what's
Heisenberg
going on.
Looking right. back 1928.
Right. Yeah. But we now know this idea can't possibly be right.
Yeah.
And it can't possibly be right because it's in flagrant contradiction to the principles of relativity. These atoms had better be small so that we haven't seen them. But relativity tells you what's small and what's big depends on motion. So who sees these atoms as small? So the existence of there has to be a sort of preferred frame of reference where these atoms of space-time look small, and that would be in great contradiction with the principles of a relativity. And, you know, people have actually investigated these ideas in more detail theoretically, and it's very difficult to make them remotely compatible. I don't mean close to compatible. I mean, you know, within 20 orders of magnitude compatible with what we already know about how accurately relativity works in our universe.
So if you're talking about probing very small scales, which you can't do because you create potentially black holes, which directions are you firing in terms of trying to work out what it is that space-time emerges from? What's more fundamental than that?
It is important to try lots of the sort of obvious naive ideas in order to get a sense for why they don't work. Also, in doing that, you learn that, and you see very, very vividly how difficult it is to modify the successful framework we have now without destroying everything. So even before knowing what particular idea is realized in our actual physical world, it is an exercise we can do as theoretical physicists is to imagine not just our world but other worlds which have the same principles, which would be governed by the same basic principles. In these other worlds, exactly the same analogous issues would arise, exactly the analogous issues of what happens to space-time at very short distances would arise. But we can try to solve these problems in these other worlds and see what the candidate solutions could look like. It's so difficult to even find one idea that's compatible with things we know, never mind whether it's actually is true in our universe. But it's so hard to find even one idea progress happens on the timescale of decades to even find one or two ideas like that can work. That if you find one, you hold on to it for dear life and you pursue its consequences. So that's what string theorists have been doing for many, many years. And the first step, the first important step towards figuring out what could replace the idea of space-time actually begins by thinking about what it is exactly that you would like such a theory to predict, what kind of observations you would actually want to be able to make. One of the more subtle and deeper aspects of the fact that there's no space-time is that, in fact, there are no very precise measurements of any sort. Forget about a theory. Forget about whether it's string theory or this or that. Forget about even talking about theories. Let's, for the moment, talk about what we can actually observe, what quantities we can observe to any precision we like. And it turns out that there is a very fundamental limitation, again, because of both quantum mechanics and gravity, on any observation we can make in a room of a fixed size, like in the nice room we're sitting in right here. If I try to measure any attribute of the physical world in this room, I can't do it to arbitrary precision. This is not a very familiar thing. It involves enormous numbers that we normally don't think about and aren't really of normal practical consequence. But they're of an enormous consequence for thinking about what the fundamental laws of physics should be about. Let me try to illustrate why we can't do it. If I try to measure any quantity at all in this room, one of the important features of quantum mechanics is that I have to do the measurement with a measuring apparatus that's very large. In fact, if I want to get an arbitrarily precise answer, I have to do it with a measuring apparatus that's infinitely big. And the reason the measuring apparatus has got to be infinitely big is that the apparatus itself is a quantum mechanical system and can undergo quantum fluctuations. So, for instance, you are made out of roughly 10 to the 30 things, 10 to the 30 atoms. And let's say you wanted to measure anything at all in this room. Pick your favorite quantity. Anything to an accuracy of better than, and here's the insane large number, to an accuracy of, let's say, 10 to the power of 10 to the 40. So Let's repeat that ridiculous number.
How many zeros are we talking about?
So we're talking about 10 to the 40 zeros.
Right.
That's 10 to the 40 zeros.
Way outside my normal experience.
Right, right. So 10 to the power of 10 to the 40 decimal places. Well, you can't do it. You can't do it because by the time you get to roughly 10 to the 30th decimal place, you yourself, as a quantum mechanical system, you could fluctuate into a cloud of dust. You could...
disturbing,
you could,
but okay.
No, right. So you could... the lots of terrible things could happen to you. So that means there's a fundamental limitation to anything that you, as a finite system, can do. There's a fundamental limitation to the accuracy to which you can measure anything. Now, once again, in a world without gravity, this doesn't matter because if you wanted to get it to such a ridiculous level of accuracy, you could just make the apparatus bigger and bigger and bigger. But in a world with gravity, something bad happens again. If we're stuck in this fixed-size room, as I try to make the apparatus bigger and bigger, it inevitably gets heavier and heavier. Mm-hmm. And at some point, before we get to make it infinitely big...
It becomes a black hole.
It becomes a black hole. Okay, we're back, back to the same problem. And so, but this is a really a basic and a deep fact. Quantum mechanics forces us to imagine dragging around everywhere we go an infinitely large apparatus in order to make precise sense of anything, and that ultimately involves a separation of the world into two pieces: an infinite piece that does the observing and a finite piece that's being observed. And gravity doesn't like that artificial distinction of the world into two pieces because everything gravitates. So we learn this rather deep fact that there's no observations of any precise kind that we can make in a fixed size room. The only kind of observations that we can make that do make sense are ones where we get to take these big apparatuses and shove them off to infinite regions of the universe, where they can become larger and larger without causing this collapse in a fixed size room. And therefore, the only kinds of precise observables that we can talk about involve experiments very much like the experiments we do at the LHC, fortunately, okay? Mm-hmm. Very much like experiments where these very large apparatuses that can measure things in principle perfectly accurately shoot particles into the interior of space and time. They bang into each other in some complicated way, and they go back out to infinitely large distances where they're captured again, and they're measured by these nice infinite apparatuses that get to make measure things with perfect accuracy. So those are the kinds of experiments which could yield perfectly sharp, perfectly accurate results.
Scattering experiments.
Now, of course, an accelerator like the LHC isn't an infinitely large experiment, but it's damn big compared to the size of the particles that it's colliding. So it's a very good approximation to this underlying observable.
Now, Nima, you said that there were two types of questions. We've been talking, or at least scratching the surface of this idea of whether space-time exists or not. And clearly, from what you're saying, you know, there are lots of questions here, not very many answers at the moment, but that's the nature of theoretical physics to some extent. What's the other type of question that sort of sits at the door now of the standard model that we can't answer?
The second class of questions has to do with another incredibly simple fact about our universe. It's so simple and so fundamental that many of us, if you're not a professional theoretical physicist, you might not even think to remark on it. But one of the most striking facts about the world is that it's big. The universe is a large place, and it has large things in it. And that's perhaps a little bit odd, given that we've learned that the basic laws of nature are fundamentally expressed and in a sense most deeply expressed and understood at very short distances. So
we're talking subatomic.
Right. So we have a universe which is enormously, enormously, enormously large, and yet and the fundamental laws act on very tiny distances. You know, much smaller than an atom, much smaller than the nucleus of the atom, much, much smaller even than that. So, for example, we're not remotely done going to the shortest possible distances that can make sense when these gravitational issues eventually arise. But even at the LHC, we're probing distances that are maybe 1,000 times smaller than the nucleus of an atom. And we could go another 1,000 million, million times smaller still before the whole idea of space-time breaks down because of the reasons that we talked about before. So even so, there's a huge sort of enormous span of a very, very short distance physics where, as we understand it, the laws of nature are best or most simply expressed. And yet we have a universe that's enormous compared to all those distance scales. And you might not think this is a pressing problem. If I asked you, you know, why this building is big, you say, "Oh, the building is big because it's made out of a humongous number of atoms. It's not a pressing problem. Why it's particularly big?" But actually, if you keep asking the question, why it's big. For example, the building can be as big as it is because the gravitational force of the Earth is not so large as to crush it. So already the bigness of the building hinges on the bigness of the Earth. And you can ask why the Earth is big. And you can sort of keep following this question down. The end of this chain of explanation always ends in the same spot, that the largeness of things in the world around us is an absolutely direct consequence of the weakness of gravity compared to all the other forces. Gravity is an astonishingly weak force compared to everything else. The gravitational force between two atoms is something like 38 orders of magnitude than the electric repulsion, for example, between two of the nuclei of the atoms. So it's an absolutely astonishingly weak force. And the existence of large structures in the universe is a direct consequence of that weakness of gravity. So that's already presupposing that the universe itself is a big place. And now why it has big things in it is the weakness of gravity. So now you can ask, why is the universe itself a big place to begin with? And that, too, depends on an important fact that mostly the universe is empty. So now we have to ask a question about a property of emptiness. And you would think, well, the universe, if it's empty, maybe it's this vast, big, infinite thing. But in fact, because of quantum mechanics, that's not what we would expect at all. The way I like to talk about it is to imagine what would happen if you gave competent enough theoretical physicists the laws of nature as we understand them, but you locked them up in a room and didn't let them look outside to see what the universe actually looked like. It's all very counterfactual, of course, because they're actually in a room which lives in the universe and so on. But anyway, so metaphorically imagine putting them in a room and not letting them see what the world looks like and ask them what they would predict, what they would expect the world would look like. Well, they would, as good theoretical physicists, they would start studying what the vacuum looks like, but they would know that even the vacuum has energy because of quantum mechanics. That nothing, so it's a very basic feature of quantum mechanics that even the vacuum should have energy. They would make an estimate for how much energy there is in the vacuum. This energy comes from sort of wild quantum mechanical fluctuations, and those fluctuations are larger and larger and more violent as you go to smaller and smaller distances. So you would be led to expect an enormous amount of energy in the vacuum, which should, by equals mc squared, once again, you expect that energy to curve space and time, according to Einstein. And the kinds of curvature that it would induce would be astonishingly smaller than anything we see around us today. We would expect the universe, for example, to be curled up to a ball, again, you know, a million times smaller than an atom or something
like
that.
This is because, of course, right. Energy and mass are equivalent.
Roughly speaking, energy and mass are equivalent. So if you have so much energy in the vacuum, you would expect things to be curved on incredibly tiny scales. Or alternately, the universe could be expanding, but it would be doubling in size, exploding in its expansion, doubling in size.
And neither of these things are what we see. 43.
And neither of it is remotely what we see. So in a sense, the most basic thing of all, why we live in a big universe, we have no good understanding of that. These theoretical physicists locked up in a room would not remotely predict that when you open the blinds and you see what the world looks like around you, that you have this enormous, enormous universe. And related to this question, once again, a consequence of these very violent quantum mechanical fluctuations, this time associated with the Higgs field, you would not expect gravity to be so much weaker than everything else. You, in fact, expect gravity and everything else to be comparable. And so you wouldn't expect the universe to have big things in it. You wouldn't expect the universe to be big, and you wouldn't expect it to have big things in it. And in a sense, the really central question is, why is there a macroscopic universe when the basic laws of nature involve violent quantum mechanical fluctuations that are increasingly violent as you go to shorter and shorter distances? So that's the second class of questions that we don't have a good understanding for. And I said that they're rather different in character than the first set of questions, because this set of questions doesn't actually involve a blatant contradiction with some thought experiment that with some actual experiment or even some thought experiment that we might imagine carrying out. Because after all, surely as physicists, we have an answer to these questions about why the universe is big and why there are big things in it. We do vastly more fancy things and make vastly fancier predictions. So what the heck are we doing? If we must deal with these issues somehow in order to do something and proceed to make much much more sophisticated predictions about other things. And there is something that we can do. It's not impossible that there is very straightforward things we can do to our equations to accommodate the fact that the universe is big and accommodate the fact that it has big things in it. And what we have to do is just say, yeah, look, there seems to be this enormous energy in the vacuum coming from quantum mechanical fluctuations. But there is another component to the energy that was just sitting there independent of the existence of quantum fluctuations, and they happen to cancel against each other. They happen to cancel against each other to an accuracy of 120 decimal places. That's what it would take. That's what it would take to accommodate the large size of the universe that we see.
Is that a comfortable thought, to have something that's just so coincidentally there?
It's not comfortable at all. It is not comfortable at all. And it's and
it's
this
a bit
is
of a
why
fix, isn't it?
This is for very obvious reasons. This is called fine tuning. It's a little bit like walking into a room and seeing a common analogy. It's like walking into a room and seeing a pencil standing on its tip. To an accuracy of 10 to the minus 120 degrees of vertical. It's possible. It's a possible way for a pencil to be. But if you saw something like that, you would probably think there's something up. You might look to see whether it's hanging from a string from the ceiling, or you might want to see if there's a little hand holding it up or something. You want to seek an explanation for this strange state of affairs. So that's why we think they are major problems, because we can give this explanation. We can accommodate it. We can certainly accommodate it. In that sense, it's different from the first class of questions, where there's no way we can accommodate the fact that space-time breaks down. That's a literal breakdown of our laws. There isn't even a fudge we can introduce. There's nothing we can do that within the standard framework, within the complete standard framework, that gives an answer to those questions. But for the second class of questions of why there's a macroscopic universe, there is something we can do. We can fine-tune. We can finally adjust the parameters of our theory to accommodate these facts. But the fine-tunings that we need to do, this 120 decimal place fine-tuning to explain why is the universe big, and the analogous fine-tuning for why it has big things in it is a mere 30 decimal places. Okay,
still not perfect. Right?
But neither one of them is they're both horrendous. But we can do them. Once we do them, and that's what we actually do today. What we do today is we do these fine adjustments of our parameters, and we merrily go along and we calculate other things, and compare them with experiment, and everything is great. But the fine tunings are so strange and so disquieting that it makes us suspect we're missing some very big piece of the puzzle.
Can I bring us back to just something a bit more grounded in some sense for a lot of our the people who are listening? I mean, the ideas we're talking about are really at the edge where there are very difficult questions. You don't even know what questions specifically to ask. You talked about the fine tuning in the second class of questions, and that's something that pops up in something that I've heard a lot of physicists talk about as the next phase of what the LHC is going to be doing. The Large Hadron Collider has done step one, testing itself and finding the Higgs and so on. And now, if you speak to anyone, the idea is now we're going to try and find evidence for something called supersymmetry, which helps to explain some of these fine tunings. Before I get you to talk about supersymmetry, though, Nima, Graham, can you take us through where supersymmetry has come from? So the standard model comes along as an idea from quantum field theory, particles, forces, numbers, etc. Mm-hmm. Takes ages to find fix and measure. But in the background, theorists are already thinking about the next thing, mm-hmm. which is supersymmetry. Now, what is this?
Well, supersymmetry is a grand overarching symmetry that I think it was in the 1970s, wasn't it, Nima, that it first came out. And I remember writing articles for The Guardian then, talking about new accelerators at CERN, where theorists, maybe not of Nima's eminence, but theorists were actually talking about finding the supersymmetric particles that occur within the theory at that time. Because the theory, it predicts that the two classes of particles, fermions and bosons, each have corresponding partners, and that these things things should show up in some way in experiments. The problem is that nobody's actually seen these things, but the mathematics of the theory are extremely compelling, and that make theorists believe that this is really a deep symmetry of nature. So we've been waiting now for 20 years, and I'm interested to know what NEMA regards as the likelihood of finding this when the LHC goes into the second part.
Well, just to say a bit more about supersymmetry, what the idea is, it's a sort of extension of the standard model in that you've got all these extra particles, so therefore, theoretically, at high enough energies, you should find that these particles are heavier than the ones we see, like the electrons and gluons and the quarks and so on. They're heavier than all those. So at the higher energies, you should be able to produce them at the Large Hadron Collider. And the LHC hasn't gone up to full energy yet. It won't for another year and a half. Yeah. But it has to be said that the people are getting worried about whether it's going to turn up or not. And what are your theories on this, Nima? If supersymmetry, are you first of all confident that new supersymmetry will be shown to be true? And if not, then what's the alternative?
Well, so first, just to add just a tiny bit to Graham's description of supersymmetry, something I mentioned before is that one of the basic things we learned in the 20th century is that a consequence of relativity and quantum mechanics is the dictation of what broadly the particles and interactions we can possibly have in any universe consistent with relativity and quantum mechanics can look like. And the sort of remarkable thing is that this gave us a very small menu of possible kinds of particles and interactions they should have. When people realized what this menu was, at the time it was realized what the menu was, we hadn't seen nature do everything that it could do. And in fact, the Higgs particle is one of two examples of something that was left, of something nature could do compatible with these general principles that we had not yet seen it do. That's why it was a particularly brave proposal. No one had ever seen an elementary, technically speaking, an elementary spin zero particle. And the Higgs came along, and it was something that was compatible with the basic principles and was eventually discovered. One of the reasons theorists like supersymmetry is it's the last thing nature can do at long enough distances, compatible with the general principles that we have not yet seen it do. It's a beautiful idea, and it's as I said, it's the last thing nature is capable of doing at sufficiently large distances. There's an ocean of possibilities when we go to very short distances, but at sufficiently large distances, we understand things are very constrained, and supersymmetry is the last thing, which is compatible with the basic principles that we have not yet seen.
Are
it
you
do.
Saying that when you say the last thing? Are you essentially saying that there's no way out after that? It's got to be there. When you say it's the last thing,
yeah, I mean, as we go to higher and higher energies, eventually the whole idea of space and time break down near these incredibly high energy scales that we're talking about before. Mm-hmm. And at that point, totally new principles are needed. But conceptually speaking, at lower energies than that, or correspondingly longer distances, we can predict ahead of time what every consistent possibility can be. And supersymmetry is the last of that class of possibilities.
So that's a very strong statement, though. You see, you're not saying it's one of, say, two or three.
No, it's not one. That's it. The game is up after that. No, that is absolutely correct. However, that does not at all say that supersymmetry needs to show up at energies accessible to the LHC. And now, there have been reasons for a long time why people expected supersymmetry to show up at the LHC. In fact, supersymmetry really should have shown up even in earlier accelerators.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And this has to do with the second class of questions we were talking about before. This has to do with the question of why there's a macroscopic universe, and more specifically with the question of why gravity is so weak compared to all the other forces. If we go back to the analogy I mentioned with the pencil standing on its tip, if you saw that funny, apparently fine-tuned situation, you might seek an explanation. You might look for a little hand holding it up, something that stabilizes the pencil. Well, the most natural way, and here I'm using the word natural in both the colloquial and the technical senses of the word, the most natural way to come up with an explanation would be to somehow remove these violent quantum mechanical fluctuations, get rid of them, so that we then get rid of the associated problem. And there's only there's a very, very few ideas for what could do that. And supersymmetry is probably the best idea for what could remove those quantum mechanical fluctuations. But independent of the specific idea of supersymmetry, there's a broader overarching philosophy that there will be some dynamical explanation for these fine-tunings, that they won't just be what they are. They won't just be fine-tunings.
The idea that obviously that means that the fine-tunings you need to make are that for every particle that we know about now, its heavy superpartner essentially does the inverse in terms of all the fluctuations.
Exactly.
So therefore, they naturally cancel each other
exactly.
out.
Exactly. And yeah. so and that's how it works in supersymmetry. Other approaches to this problem have other particles that do this same mirroring kind of cancellation.
I think we're all waiting to see if any of the heavy partner particles of supersymmetry turn up in the next couple of years. I mean, is there a point at which theoreticians like you think to yourself, right, this can't be right? If nothing turns up in the next run of the LHC, which some physicists, experimentalists are thinking may happen, it might be that...
Well, they don't know.
They suspect.
Well, let's do the experiment first.
Yeah. So indeed, it's not just supersymmetry. It's this broader idea that these apparent fine tunings are just that. They're just apparent, and there's some natural understanding for them. And it's that broad idea which is being put under, definitely being put under pressure by the fact that we haven't seen anything yet at the LHC. I should say that it isn't that everything was going along just swimmingly great as far as theorists were concerned. And then the LHC came along and we haven't seen supersymmetry yet. So all of a sudden we're worried now. In fact, we've been worried for a while. We've been worried. I think the fair summary of the situation, at least from my point of view, is that I'm not at present particularly more worried about supersymmetry or any other natural solution, but supersymmetry is the best one. So let's use supersymmetry as a stand-in. I'm not particularly more worried about supersymmetry than I was before the current results of the LHC. But that's already because I was somewhat worried beforehand. And it's because this natural physics could have shown up already in the late 1980s and early 1990s. And the fact that it hasn't shown up, not only directly in particle colliders, but also indirectly. People have been looking for indirect effects for all this new physics we should have lying around, which could have led to precision deviations from very, very subtle but precise measurements that can be performed in tabletop experiments or lower energy experiments. And none of those things have shown up. So there's been this sort of there is some sense of disquiet about this. But I want to stress it's not supersymmetry being killed and some other idea is then going to be right if that's wrong. There's the broader idea of this whole guiding philosophy for expecting new physics at exactly the energies being probed by the LHC. That's the idea which is under some pressure now. It's the 11th hour for something to show up. I think that's certainly true.
But I think this is what's true, isn't it? That actually whatever happens in the next run of the Large Hadron Collider, it's the highest energies experiments that we've managed to do so far. Physicists managed to do it so far. And whatever happens, whether supersymmetry comes along as the right answer or something bigger than that or whatever else, there is going to be brand new physics for the first time in a long time.
Actually, you see, often the Higgs is described in the way we even talked about it earlier today, is described as old physics and not when we're looking for new physics. Really, in actual fact, the Higgs is really new physics. It's new physics in the sense that we've never seen anything like it in nature before. We've seen the basic sorts of phenomenon in one language of describing it, symmetry breaking and other things like that. We've seen that kind of phenomenon all kinds of other places in physics. But we've never seen it associated with such a simple mechanism, a single particle, and without a whole bunch of other associated forces and particles coming along for the ride. So already the fact that we have something as simple as the Higgs describing the relevant physics is a big surprise. We've never seen it anywhere else before in a state of nature. And that's really the fact that we're trying to cope with and trying to understand. Much more complicated theories would have been much more conservative, would have been much more like other things that are seen in physics. Something as simple as the Higgs is difficult to understand.
Can I just ask you, when you say simple, you're talking about there being a first spin zero fundamental particle.
A single spin zero fundamental particle and nothing else as far as we can see. Right. And so... That's why, as you say, we're in a kind of a win-win situation, at least from the as far as the conceptual consequences of whatever we discover at the LHC. Because whatever we discover is going to throw us down one direction or another in our continuing understanding of fundamental physics. And actually, the issue that's now really at stake at the LHC is this really overarching one. Is there going to be a natural explanation for the Higgs? Are we going to discover something, some mechanism that makes sense of the Higgs's existence? Or are we going to find that the Higgs is all alone with no new physics showing up to the energies that we probe at the LHC? If it's the first where we do discover superpartners or something else, great. Many of us expected it. It's a logical continuation of 100 years of development in theoretical physics. I should say that questions of this sort have come up. This isn't the first time that questions of this sort have come up in the last 100 years. Two or three times, very similar questions have come up, and there have been and solutions have appeared of precisely the same sort, sort of precisely analogous to supersymmetry and its variants. So this isn't something that we're just inventing out of thin air this time. You know, it's been perfectly mirrored a number of times in the last 100 years, which is why it's all the more surprising and disquieting that it's not working out that way, at least as simply or as obviously than it could have. If we discover supersymmetry when the LHC turns on, that'll be spectacular. It'll be thought of as it appearing at the 11th hour because, again, it could have shown up earlier. Now, let's say we go to the opposite end. It's 2020, and we continue to see the Higgs and nothing else at the LHC. This is, in a sense, even more dramatic. Very few people expected it. Some of us thought that something like this might happen just because taking the evidence seriously from the absence of direct and indirect hints for this new physics for a while. But it's very shocking. It would give us very concrete and direct evidence for some kind of delicate cancellation between totally unrelated parameters of our theory being responsible for something as basic as the existence of the Higgs. And having evidence for fine-tuning like that at the kind of percent level is what we'll have in our hands if we see the Higgs and nothing else at the LHC by 2020. Whoa. But one way or another, these two roads have sort of totally different consequences for our picture of what's going on with fundamental physics. But it's really up to experiment to decide now and tell us.
What you're saying essentially, I think if I may summarize in one way, is what physicists a lot of times say, which is that they have an idea of what might happen, they're very confident it'll happen. But if that doesn't happen and they're wrong, they're very excited about that too, because it means that they have to completely redraw the map somewhere else. I think which is what Stephen Hawking was saying also about the Higgs. I mean, a lot of people didn't believe the Higgs would turn up.
Including him.
But you, Nima, obviously bet a lot of money on the fact that Higgs... Can we just finish with this? You bet a year's worth of salary on the fact that the Higgs would turn up. And
yes,
many people who've traipsed through this podcast and various other more prestigious places have said the Higgs may not have ever turned up. This is before it did turn up, of course. What was it that made you so confident about it?
Well, the situation is really was totally different for the Higgs versus supersymmetry and some of these other ideas, because in a sense, before we knew about the Higgs, if we took the particles of the Standard Model without the Higgs, they were infected with a very severe problem, very analogous to the first set of questions that we talked about. If you tried to extrapolate the particles and forces that we knew without the Higgs, you ran into massive theoretical inconsistencies, already just a factor of 5 or 10 higher energies than the energies that were available to us. And theorists had thought for a long time about the kinds of things that could solve the problem. The Higgs was by far the simplest possibility for what would solve it. And not only that, there were strong, very strong indirect experimental hints from the late 80s and early 90s that it had to be the Higgs. It couldn't be these much more complicated variants. It had to be the Higgs, and the Higgs mass needed to be in a fairly narrow window. And it was discovered smack in the middle of that fairly narrow window. So
were there moments where you were worried about your bets?
Not once.
Test that. It
not,
is true.
Not once.
He wasn't worried.
No, I can say. And you're absolutely right, Alok, that there were about many of NEMA's peers who got very cold feet indeed. But I can honestly attest to the fact that NEMA never doubted it. Even when you were publishing articles saying that businesses were very worried about
it. Well, no, not even in moments before going to sleep, you think, hang on.
No, really. I mean, I'm all kidding aside. No, I absolutely not. Because, I mean, one often talks in this way, just as you were saying a second ago, that theoretical physicists make predictions and either they're right and they're very happy or they're wrong and they're even happier because they get to go back to the drawing board. And there's some truth to that. But maybe slightly more accurately, there are aspects of our theories that we're very confident about. The aspects that we're very confident about have this, again, as Steve Weinberg likes to say, are the aspects that have a sense of inevitability about them, the aspects that follow from first principles that you can't monkey with, that are definitely not in your head. They're not an element of how you choose to talk about things. They reflect reality in some direct way, or there are questions that are directly physical. And the Higgs is part of that architecture of 20th century physics. Of course, we came to understand things so well to understand the origin of this inevitability. But when you have a sort of a taste of that kind of power of these principles to describe what the world looks like, you don't give it up easily, and you sort of revel in it. The issues with supersymmetry and the second class of questions, we're not 100% sure that they're correct questions about the world because, as I said already, it's possible to accommodate the fact that the universe is large. It's possible to make these fine-tunings. And it's possible we'll come up with different explanations for what underlies those.
But you're not going to bet a year's salary for that.
No. I will happily bet $50 that supersymmetry will be discovered, but I won't bet a year's salary. However, I would bet several years of salary that the supersymmetry would be discovered if we had truly gigantic accelerators eventually.
So you're saying you do believe it is a fundamental symmetry, right? It is there.
I think
it's just a question of
I would find it impossible to believe that nature has done everything that it can do, including the Higgs, and doesn't complete the menu of what it can do by being supersymmetric. But that doesn't mean that it will do it at accessible energies.
If you're blessed to live to your 85, you really think you're going to see it?
No. Not necessarily.
Maybe,
it's not obvious.
Maybe
the
our experiments will just get
right
there. Yeah. Unless we build cosmological experiments of some sort. But Nima, just to say, you talked about how it's very hard to give up this taste of understanding things at that level. I mean, I think we've had 0.02 × 10⁻³% taste of what it must be like to be in your world, and it's very hard to give up. I can't imagine anything else is particularly satisfying when you don't think about these sorts of things. Meanwhile, Nima, thank you very much, and Graham, thank you very much indeed as well.
And that's all we have for this week. The Collider exhibition at the Science Museum London runs until May next year and is the perfect companion piece for this podcast. If you're in London, don't miss it. Remember, for the best science news and features on the web, go to theguardian.com/science. Dr. Kevin Fong will be sitting in for Alok Jha next week. This podcast was produced by me, Jason Phipps, but from Alok Jha and my good self, thanks for listening and come back next Monday.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.